You're listening to the podcast for Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Buy tickets to upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org. Want even more Inforum? Find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as InforumSF.
Hi, everyone. Can you hear me? Hello, my name is Carlo. I am a founder of some startups you've never heard of, but more importantly, board president for Inforum, and it means a lot that you're here tonight. This is a special night for us. Now, you know, over the years, I've been coming to the Commonwealth Club since 1994, when I was 16 years old. I was an undocumented immigrant, came here for my first event. I couldn't stop coming. And over the years, people keep asking me why I come. And the answer changes all the time. Right now, the answer is that all of you are here, and we have really amazing people here. But when it first started, I wanted to know what successful people look like. And I saw the president of the Czech Republic come and speak. Turns out he's not that much smarter or better than me. He just had a few more years to figure it out. And I've been trying to bring more people to come to the Commonwealth Club since. And how many of you are here because of a board member? Great. Can we have the Inforum board members stand up, please? So I'm going to try to name all 11 of you. There's Corlin. Keep standing. You know. If I'm going to be up here, it's going to be awkward for everybody. There's Corlin, Eva, Nicole, Melissa, Kimberly, Savannah, Libby, Anjali, and there's another Kimberly that's not here tonight because she's teaching at USF. But take a seat, please. Thank you for coming tonight. Also want to thank all the If I didn't call your name, you don't sit down. Okay, so I also want to thank all the past board members. There's Jen here. Tim is here. I think I saw Ida bought a ticket, but I don't see her. But, you know, the Commonwealth Club isn't about the board members. We have great speakers, and it's still not about the great speakers that we have, even though we have really good ones tonight, too. I do want to share with you what that's about. But in the meantime, I'm going to give you 30 seconds to turn to three people and ask a question you're not supposed to ask. What do you do for a living? Okay, I'll give you 30 seconds starting right now. Okay, 15 seconds. 15 seconds. Five, four, three, two, one. Shh. I like how that always works. All right, so show of hands, who met somebody impressive tonight? Everyone except for everyone sitting by Cortland. We do get great speakers here. We've been around for 114 years. We've had every U.S. president come and speak except for a couple. One of them will probably try less, but this is my take on it. Until he figures out where Namibia is, I guess. But, you know, we have great speakers here. We have 450 events a year. So if you want to talk about anything, you want to learn about something, come to the Commonwealth Club. 450 events a year means we got a lot of great speakers. like Kara and Tristan and Marissa is going to moderate this. And there's a lot of things to be said and a lot of things to be learned. But the speakers are just the beginning of it. What I've learned over the years with the Commonwealth Club is that the Commonwealth Club is about continuing the conversation, making sure that you have people that are impressive around you, that you learn from, that you dare to understand with. And with that being said, thank you again for coming to our, I'm tempted to say our new home, but really, this is the first home we've ever had in 114 years. So that means you're part of the history, the present, and the future, because you're going to come back and meet more people here. And with that being said, I forgot one board member. Frank Meek, no, just kidding. Tom. Tom Nguyen. Come around. Okay, there you go. Thank you, everybody.
Awesome. Thank you, Carlo, I think. All right. So howdy, folks. My name is Tom Nguyen, and some of us know that I'm a board member of Inforum. No. So the thing is, I have always been a nerd. In college, I'd actually get up on Saturdays and look forward to turning on the radio to listen to the Commonwealth Club. So that, like, 114 years, like, I was listening to them for a good amount of that time, of my lifetime. So, like, listening to all, like, people who are thought leaders in so many different spaces is, like, how I learned about the world. And I think I learned more those mornings than when I actually showed up to some classes. So I'll confess, though, it was only when I moved to San Francisco that I realized the Commonwealth Club is an actual place where people come together. Carla mentioned this is our first real home. We've been renters for some time all around the city, and we're finally homeowners today, which is really exciting. But what's amazing about it is that here is this amazing, thoughtful community of people. Speakers, amazing folks like Karen and Tristan, and audience members, you guys. And it's accessible to the whole world, right? Like, on a random Thursday night, you can just walk into a room and get inspired. You can just hang out with Judy Blume and Molly Ringwald, or Tim Ferriss and Rashida Jones, Mark Benioff, Charles Duhigg and his mariachi band, which is something I've never seen with a Pulitzer Prize winning author before, but he brought his own with him. And all of them are talking off the cuff, unscripted. It's pretty amazing. Recently, we hosted journalists Christina Rieske of Mother Jones and Nicole Hannah Jones of the New York Times Magazine. And they talked about segregation in the U.S. public school system to a sold-out room. I actually studied education in grad school, and I learned so much. And the thing is, afterwards, Christina wrote to us and said, "I've never gotten so much positive feedback from a talk." And she told us that she was with people who care about the subject and are making sure me and Nicole can go out there and do our best. Thank you so much for helping us raise these powerful issues at such a pivotal time for our country. So speakers like Christina and Nicole have a venue to inspire people face-to-face here at Inforum. And they leave inspired by this community, by folks like you guys, right? It's a two-way conversation. And that's something like we want to keep on reminding ourselves of, is that it's not just like people talking to you and you just responding with a thumbs up or a like. It's you engaging in a real dialogue about interesting things and nerding out with your neighbors about stuff that you didn't know anything about an hour before and suddenly know so much about because the expert in the world has just like downloaded this knowledge and this insight straight into your brain. And now we get to talk about it here. So by the way, actually yesterday, Nicole was actually just named a MacArthur Genius Grant Award winner, and these are the people that you're going to be having conversations with. As you guys come to more Inforum events, we just want to let you guys know that we want to hear from you, whether that's in person or in social media or email. But tell us about your experiences here at the club, right? Like, what topic do you want to learn more about? Like, who do you want to see next? Who do you want to meet next? Because this is your space now to enjoy and nerd out on great conversations. So maybe over a drink while meeting a new friend. So with that, Speaking of actually great conversations, so tonight we're lucky enough to get to chat with two fascinating, awesome, not nerdy, but incredibly cool people. So Bay Area CEO is Tristan Walker, founder and CEO of beauty company Walker & Company, and Kara Golden, the CEO of beverage company Hint Incorporated. We've all been enjoying super tastiness from you guys. So these two leaders are known for carving out whole new niches in old school industries, changing them completely, solving problems, and building platforms for other people, for future entrepreneurs and leaders to grow from and build from, and so much more. So we'll let them tell you about that. And so please welcome Kara, Tristan, and our moderator, Marissa Levine, the director of Inforum.
Thanks so much. Hello, everyone.
Thanks.
Hello.
Hi.
Let everybody get seated. So as Tom said, this is more for the purposes of the recording, should this make it to radio. I'm Marissa Levine, the director of Inforum at the Commonwealth Club, and I am very excited to be interviewing not one, but two CEOs tonight. Two leaders who, as our board member Tom mentioned, make major waves. Kara Golden is infamous for taking on the big sugary beverage companies with a bottle of what she's got in her chair right now, Hint Water. And Tristan Walker is shaking up the traditional beauty industry. These are people who love shirking the status quo, and we love that at Inforum. So thank you guys for joining us for one of our inaugural talks at our new home.
Thanks for having me.
Quick bio on both of them, and then we'll let them talk more. Kara is the founder and CEO of Hint. Hopefully you grabbed a bottle at the bar on your way in. A healthy lifestyle brand that produces the leading unsweetened flavored water, also in fridges across Silicon Valley, for many of you who live here. Hint also recently launched a sunscreen spray that is oxybenzone and paraben-free, another great extension of their healthy brand. She's received too many awards to count, so we're going to skip that part. But before Hint, she was the vice president of shopping and e-commerce partnerships at AOL. And in 2016, she launched the Kara Network, a digital resource and mentoring platform for aspiring and established entrepreneurs. Please welcome Kara Golden.
Oh, thanks.
And Tristan Walker, who we've actually had on stage at Inforum before, thank you for coming back to us. We hope that's a good sign, is the founder and CEO of Walker & Company, which focuses on creating health and beauty products for people of color. The Bevel Razor System was their first brand, and they just launched Form, My Ponytail Thanks You.
Wonderful.
Thank you. A hair care line for women. Before Walker & Company, Tristan worked everywhere from J.P. Morgan to Foursquare, spending time as an entrepreneur in residence at Andreessen Horowitz, and co-founded Code 2040, a nonprofit focused on creating access, awareness, and opportunity for top Black and Latino engineering talent across technology. Please welcome Tristan Walker. Now, on folks' name tags, when they came in, we asked them two questions. And so I'm going to ask you guys to answer one for us. What is something that you are super excited about these days? Maybe something you're working on or something you're super curious about? Something you don't know a lot about? Tristan, you're up.
Yeah, no, it's fine. You know, it's funny because I've been thinking a lot about this recently. There's just no good news anymore, right? And it's like, man, where's the happiness? So let me tell you what gets me excited, and this is really a function of just my business too. You know, I've told folks on multiple occasions that I'm dedicating my life to the demographic shift happening in this country. I think there's a lot of goodness in that. When we think about folks of color in this country, we are the cultural arbiters of the world, right? And you know, one thing I think a lot about is how we help kind of the greatest consumer demographic on the planet be the best producer demographic on the planet, and what goodness comes in that, right? And I think about some of the stuff that we're not only doing with kind of Walker & Company as producers, but some of the stuff that's getting generated out of my not-for-profit Code 2040. You know, we've been doing it for about 5 years now, and we're starting to see fellows come out of the program starting their own companies, right? So that thesis is actually reigning true, and it's a bit of happiness in a world of gloom for me. So I'm very, very excited about that.
That's awesome. And we're big fans. We had your co-founder, Laura Weedman Powers, on stage with
fantastic.
Us the other day.
It's awesome.
And Kara, what about you? What are you excited or curious about these days?
So I think it has a little bit to do with news, but it also has to do with, you know, kind of a frustration, frankly, of information to consumers about what's really, you know, good for them and what's not really good for them. And, you know, it sort of led me ultimately to launch Hint, but as I see products, you know, like yours that are solving problems, like it's, mm-hmm. finally, you know, we're actually doing things and we're breaking through, and there's great brands that are doing it in lots of different categories. And I think we're now seeing that large brands don't necessarily win just because they're big. And actually, I think a lot of people are really starting to feel like the larger the brand, the less trust there is in that brand. So it's so I think that that's something that I'm very curious about over, you know, the next few years, that what is actually going to happen to brands that are really able to, you know, break through versus these, you know, large iconic brands that are out there. You know, as I said to my daughter the other day, there was actually a brand called Kodak that was a very large company, right?
Are those all real pictures?
Right. Yeah. So she's the same person who said to me, whoa, Amazon was just books at one point? Yeah, I had no idea, right? So I think that brands, you know, the world is changing, and I personally would be afraid to be sitting inside of a really large brand today, because I think it's very, very hard to develop the trust with the consumer if you're sitting inside one of those large brands.
That's right.
So actually, that's going to lead me. You guys are big on Twitter, and I actually understand you guys met on Twitter and had never met in real life until tonight.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's wonderful.
We're pals on Twitter, though.
You know, I
we think a lot alike.
I have a you know, we every now and then we get celebrities. They either come to the office, I get to meet them, and I'm not one to really get starstruck. I got starstruck when I met Carol.
Oh, stop.
No, I'm serious. I really want to say this, because little do a few folks know, I actually wanted to start a beverage company, gosh, it's like 8 years ago or so. Ended up not doing it, and Hint was like a huge inspiration of mine. So it's funny how like Twitter just brings the world together a little bit. And every now and then, look, you know, you see kind of who likes each other's tweets and that sort of thing. So we have this like liking battle going on that I really appreciate. But I'm truly starstruck by Kara. So, I think she's a
wonderful. That's so nice. Well, feelings mutual. So
appreciate it.
Yeah, seriously.
How do you guys feel? So you write, both of you use Twitter personally and for your brands. Mm-hmm. I follow both of you. We, you know, see all of the things that you talk about. And you guys actually choose to talk about not just your brands on Twitter. Is that true?
Oh, yeah, to a fault.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about that, because I think we're facing a time right now where there's a lot of things being said on Twitter. There's a lot of news on Twitter. There's a lot of things that might not be true on Twitter. And both of you have been pretty vocal, you know, on that platform and about politics in general. What led you to decide to do that versus to be more siloed, to kind of act like a big brand that might not weigh in on things like that?
Well, I think in our case, we've never acted like a big brand. I've never acted like mm-hmm. a big brand. I just like speaking the truth, right? So, you know, folks who know me in person, folks who know me on Twitter, you know, hopefully they're consistent. I try to be consistent. Sometimes I talk too much, right? But for me, it's all about authenticity, right? What actually matters to me, whether it's politics, brand, et cetera. So I try and be very consistent. All the stuff that's been happening over the past 12 months or so has been very, very frustrating. But also think that it's an opportunity to show your courage, right? Like there are a lot of folks that are unwilling to speak up, right? And especially for someone like me, right? Where, look, here's just the brash reality. I'm a black man living in the U.S., right? At times scared for my life, right? With everything that's going on. And I think it's important to have a voice that folks are willing to listen to. And as long as I've been blessed with that platform to speak the truth, it's my duty to speak the truth. And again, like, I don't think that there's any different for the past 12 months. It just so happens that, you know, truth has been a bit of a requirement over the past 12 months. And I think it's on me to actually kind of promulgate that as much as I can. And if I don't, this stuff will continue, and I refuse to let it.
Kara, what about you? Is there anything you won't, is there anything either of you won't comment on publicly? Because I think both of you seem like you're pretty open. Both of you have commented on quite a few things. Is there anything that you don't talk about publicly? That's a no from Tristan for anybody listening at home, shaking his head.
No, look, I mean, for me, you know, I mentioned this last time I was at Inform. I'm sorry, Kara. I knew.
No, go for it.
You know, there's something that I care a lot about, and I talk a lot about my values, right? Like, you know, courage, inspiration, respect, judgment, wellness, and loyalty. And as long as the thing that I want to talk about really kind of helps evangelize those things, I talk about it, right? And I don't think anything is safe or protected from that. If it deserves to be said, it deserves to be said. As long as I'm showing respect and courage in that, I'll do it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that the one line that I probably cross or don't cross, I should say, is with my kids. Mm-hmm. So I just, because I think that the older they get to, you know, I have a bigger Twitter following than they do, right? And so they're and so they're a little concerned about, you know, me saying anything about, they're mini adults, but they're, so I think that that's where I sort of draw the line on it. But I think, you know, today I think that the founders that can actually speak up and allow people to actually get to know them are the ones that actually can develop a brand in a way that is not just about advertising, because people are really looking at what is that founder, what do they represent. And, you know, and frankly, you know, sometimes, I mean, I had a situation earlier this year where I was an Obama appointee and was working for the Secretary of Commerce and a group called NACI. And I decided to leave the Trump administration, even though it was a very, very hard decision, because it was a two-year commitment that I had made. And I really thought long and hard about it, but I didn't believe that President Trump really was had the same mindset around entrepreneurism and growth that I had signed up for. So when I left, I did it not only for my own personal views, but because I was running a company filled with people that basically were looking at their fearless leader and saying, you know, what is she doing when she's going off and working for this person? So there were a lot of issues. And then also my kids saying, like, what are you doing? Like, what, why are you working with this person? And it was, and while it was, you know, an honor to be a part of it, I also felt like I had to tell people while I was, why I was leaving, including the group that I was working with. And some of them were not too happy that I was leaving. And so when I did broadcast that, I did a Medium article and said, actually wrote a letter to my company and to my board and my investors. I had one investor, actually, that came back and was very upset that I left, not because they believed that I was being a quitter, but really because they believed in what Trump was doing. And they thought that I was, that it was wrong that I was leaving, and actually asked me to step down from Hint because of this decision, that it was a bigger sign of sort of what I was doing. And, but, you know, the other 90 investors that we have in the company, actually, I asked them to respond after hearing that, and they told me to continue on, and that guy doesn't know what he's talking about, mm-hmm. and everything else. But it was, frankly, you know, it was a place where I grew a lot, and while I always, you know, felt like I sort of said what was on my mind, and, you know, I believe in authenticity and all of those things, it was probably one of the biggest challenges that I've had, because I really think that politics is something that maybe it's become clearer to a lot of people, but, you know, back in January, it wasn't so clear to a lot of people, and I think the world was, like, very, very divided. So being a leader of a company that has nothing to do with politics, and, you know, I do it all over again, but it was, I can't say that it was a totally easy, you know, after the announcement type of thing.
Yeah, one thing, like, I have a 3-year-old son, and I don't think about this. I'm just thinking about it in the context of what Kara just said. You know, the internet's written in ink, and when my son's 20 years old, I want to know what side I was on. It's really that simple. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with just this election. It's every single thing that I do, right? And that's critical for me. And the one thing that I've actually found over the past few months, you know, look, I mean, I say a lot of fairly courageous things, and a lot of these kind of mentors or advisors that I've had over the years have kind of, like, touted this idea of the need of courage. And it's just so fascinating how many of them have gone silent, right? Just to see and observe how much truth they're willing to accept for themselves has been a bit disappointing, right? And as long as that continues, I cannot kind of fall victim to that. So it's very, very important for me to continue to just be as public in my stance on this stuff as possible.
So on that note for both of you, I think that's an incredibly
courageous story that you shared, and you talk a lot about folks who inspire you. Who are some of the folks that are inspiring to you right now? Not necessarily in this political landscape, but people who are also doing courageous things in their industries and their worlds with their work. Like, who are people that you think we should be looking at on that front?
So, one of our investors is John Legend, and I'm such a super fan on so many fronts. I mean, he's been an investor in our company for 9 years prior to, him coming out with the big album. And, you know, he's such a good guy. and actually, you know, if he cares, actually he cares very much about the presidential situation right now, but he is a big, big believer in two things: African-American incarceration and what we're actually putting into our bodies. And if you talk to him, he's very clear about that. And like, knowing somebody that really understands what they believe in, I think has allowed me to, you know, look at myself and be able to say, you know, what do you believe in? And frankly, you know, try and actually tell my team, like, the same thing. Like, what do you believe in? Tell my kids, what do you believe in? And really pushing on that. And also, you know, through my mentorship program too, I'm frequently saying that to, you know, people who are trying to start companies. It's like, look, do you believe in this? What's your gut say? Like, going back and really doing those kind of checks. Because if you surround yourself with people, you know, like John and others that are, you know, really doing it and really, you know, living life, and, you know, I think that good things happen. So,
yeah, for me, my answer is a little bit strange and perhaps unexpected. As I've grown up, I've been married 10 years now. I have a 3-year-old son. And, you know, 10 years ago, you know, I would have, like, the Obamas of the world, all the celebrities of the world. You know, my inspiration is markedly different now. It's just the people that I find to be happy, right? And that could be anybody in this room. And I've realized that there are two things thematically for folks that, you know, I observe to be fairly happy. Number one, the folks that actually follow the values that they set out for themselves consistently, right? And they're unwavering in that commitment to their values. You'd be surprised by how many folks kind of waver off of that. And it's very, very surprising to me. The second thing, especially where we are, we have a brand that I believe to be fairly famous. And a lot of folks are really, really excited about what we're doing with our brands, et cetera. But, you know, a lot of individuals who are out in the world who just are not seeking gain, who are comfortable with what they already have, you know, want to be the best parents they can be, want to raise their sons and daughters in accordance to their values and do it consistently, right? I'm a very different person now, kind of 10 years later, now that I've been exposed to those folks a little bit more. And as I've learned a little bit more about my values, the one thing that I've learned is that I've had a willingness to kind of lose friends as a result of it, right? And one thing I tell a lot of kind of folks on my team is we try and hire only people that kind of fit the values of the organization. And for me, I only try and kind of befriend people that kind of share my values. And the thing that, is kind of the best example, I like to say, I'll always hire and or befriend someone who's a jerk but shares my values, right? But I'll never kind of befriend somebody who's a really nice person who doesn't share my values, right? Mm. And I can grow in that, right? And that jerkhood, quote unquote, can actually be managed and taught as long as we share those values together. So my inspiration are the folks that believe that to be the case. And my inspiration are kind of not only my employees, but my friends who share my values.
I like that a lot. I think that, and that actually is interesting hearing you talk about hiring, and you've talked a lot about your team too. I think both of you don't talk about your brands as these entities. Mm-hmm. You talk about your brands as being the people that build these companies with you. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about how you've built those companies? Yeah. I know you both have quite a few colleagues in the audience. You guys can nod or shake your heads if you think they're not speaking the truth on stage right now. But I read an article recently about people who hire for culture fit or for culture contribution, and kind of thinking about what that looks like. Is it somebody like, do you have a model for what it looks like to work at Walker & Company? Or do you have a model for what it looks like to work at Hint? Because the conversation there is, does that mean you're hiring what looks like or sounds like you? And how does that kind of fit in with both of your companies? You know, in Silicon Valley, where often companies are not as diverse or as inclusive as folks might like to be.
Yes.
Kara, I'm going to go to you for a second.
No, good. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. So for me, I mean, just given my seat, the customers that we serve, who I am, my not-for-profit, implicit bias is a part of me every single second of every day of my life, right? So my number one goal is to destroy that. Look, a lot of folks are disadvantaged by this fact. You know, we can talk about all the explicit stuff, but so many people do not understand the magnitude and the impact of what implicit bias can do to destroy organizations, right? And destroy friendships and destroy relationships, et cetera. So, you know, to the values thing, like, we hire for those quite literally. You know, we want to make sure you can do the job, but we're going to ask you leading questions to get at your courage and your inspiration and your respect and your judgment and your wellness and your loyalty, right? You know, throughout the year when you're rated kind of semi-annually, you're rated against your goal attainment, but also your adherence to the values within the organization, your courage and your respect, et cetera. Now, what does that do? It ensures some semblance of a consistency. It also prevents us from hiring folks that make you laugh, folks that, you know, you just, you know, play golf and you play golf and now you think that this is a culture fit. I think culture fit is the worst phrase ever created in humankind, specifically because by definition it leads to implicit bias. Everybody just needs to get rid of that shit. I'm sorry.
That's fine. We bleep you.
Like, it is just so destructive, especially these days when you have so much great genius and ingenuity, right, and excitement about kind of changing things. You want people to be a part and have a seat at the table. And the only way you do that, at least in my opinion, is consistency and values.
Kara, what about you guys? What does it look like to have built Hint? And do you agree with everything Tristan's saying? Do you guys have different ways you go about hiring?
Yeah, and so, building your brand? You know, we really, I mean, I think we're 130 people now in the company throughout the country. We have a lot of people working remotely, more people working remotely than not. But I think it was, I've always been a big believer that the team members that I valued the most that I've worked with in the past were people who were very different from me and had different skill sets. So versus the people that I was, you know, actually that were on my team that I was friends with and wanted to go grab beers with were the people that were more like me more. So I've always been very good at figuring out, okay, that's a skill set that we don't have on this team and we need to grab them. I think, first of all, I totally agree. I mean, it's got to have, you know, the person's got to have integrity. I actually really like people who are funny because I think especially in a startup environment, it's very, you can have a very dry sense of humor, but you have to, like, you know, have some sort of pulse where you're like actually enjoyable to be around. But I think that the key thing is finding people that are different from you. So, and you know, I'm a big believer. I say to my girlfriends too, I've been married now for 23 years. And if any of you have met Theo, who is also our chief operating officer, which is crazy, we are married and we work together, which is absolutely nuts, but it seems to work. But we're very different people. And so I really believe that's the trick, is finding, you know, whether it's your personal life or whether it's, you know, your work life, it's a balance, right? And you've got to find that person that really, like, completes you in some way and groups of people that really help you do what you want to get done in your company as well. And it's not easy because there's a lot of nice people that walk through the door and that you feel like, oh gosh, they're so great, I want to hire them and it'd be awesome. But I think, you know, you hire people that really do have different skill sets and first and foremost too, smart. So I think that's another really, really key thing.
Yeah, it's interesting. Look, people choose their different paths. For me, I only want to work people who are like me, right? And, you know, I know it's kind of like your not so conventional advice, but also think life's too short to be around folks that, like, are kind of too risky, right? And I think like attracts like. You know, I reflected a lot on this too. Like, my wife and I, for all intents and purposes, are fairly similar. Like, we have some different skill sets, but we're very alike, right? And that served me a lot better, at least in my leadership, in my leadership style. But, you know, it's interesting to see how, look, different people are different and different folks have different management styles for their success. It just hasn't served me well, personally, when I'm kind of actively hiring folks who are different from me.
Interesting. So would you ever work with your wife?
No. No. No.
Interesting. And so did you guys always plan to work together, Kara, no. you and your husband? How no. did that happen? That's actually kind of an interesting.
So we were, so he was an attorney at Netscape. He was an intellectual property attorney, and I was at AOL, and I lived on the plane for many years, primarily because he was, we were sort of stuck here in California because he had to pass the bar, and we were like, we're not moving.
Once and, you pass that California bar,
yeah,
that's it.
Yeah. And so we, so I was in a little unknown startup that, or very little known startup that was a Steve Jobs idea that it was a spin out of Apple called Two Market. And it was doing CD-ROM shopping, and it was Steve's idea that, that basically he'd put all the graphics on a disc, and if and the consumer wouldn't actually know that the all the graphics were living on a disc because we would just send out these discs to people. And so baud modem speeds at that time were like, you know, 9600 baud modems. They were super, super slow. There was a lot of text-based services. I'm completely aging myself through this talk. Anyway, that's how it was. And so AOL acquired us, and then through the acquisition, they said they had a bunch of buttons on the screen, and they said a couple people do news and sports, and Kara, you do shopping. And so I get this job, and they're like, oh, and by the way, the job's in Virginia. And so you have to commute to Virginia. So I commuted every Monday morning for many, many years and basically didn't see my husband for a long time and had a couple of kids. I have four kids now. And basically after leaving AOL, I decided I want to do something that really makes a difference. And I kept telling people that statement, and people kept introducing me to nonprofits. And I thought, maybe, I don't know, sounds kind of interesting. And I basically was looking at, you know, I want to do something that I think really gets me excited every day. And it, like, I don't know if that's tech or not. And I also had, just going into a little bit of the founder story, so I was 55 pounds overweight after losing baby weight. I had terrible adult acne. I had never had acne as a teenager, so my life was sort of, I kept looking in the mirror saying, you know, what's wrong with me? I was really tired. I was like, you know, thinking maybe, you know, something's wrong. I'm not exactly sure what it is. So I went to a bunch of different doctors, and the response back from doctors was, you had babies too close to one another. And I kept saying, well, I've already done that, so there's not really a whole lot that I can do, right? And then, you know, you're hormonal. That was like another statement that, like, doctors really like to tell women after they've had babies. And so I was offered all kinds of drugs and medication, and I didn't have a diagnosis. And so I thought, no diagnosis, no drugs. And so I went home and thought, I don't want to take the drugs that they're offering me. And so I opened up my refrigerator, and I found at that point that I went to go grab a diet. I'm supposed to not say Diet Coke, but I'll say Diet Coke. So I said a Diet Coke.
We can bleep that out too.
And so I grabbed the Diet Coke, and I turned the label around, and I started looking at the ingredients. And I thought, I don't understand the ingredients. That's in Diet Coke, so I'm not going to drink it anymore. And my husband was in the kitchen, and he was like, you've been drinking that for a long time. Like, you really like your Diet Coke a lot. And I said, nope, I'm just going to throw it in the garbage. And I grew up in Arizona. I should have been drinking lots of water, but I just never did. I drank Diet Coke all the time. I was a competitive gymnast growing up, and I mean, everybody now that sees me, they're like, can't believe you don't have that Diet Coke anymore. You were always, so it was really, you know,
did you go cold
part
turkey
of the story.
When you did it?
Cold turkey. And so 2.5 weeks later, I lost 24 pounds just by dropping diet soda. And then 6 months later, I lost 55 pounds. Wow. And then I went back to the doctor that I had seen in New York and said, I actually think I'm sick. Like, I really think I cannot keep weight on, and I don't know what to do. And he was like, well, maybe you're on too much medication. And I'm like, no, I actually, you know, didn't take any of the medication. And so he said, then you should probably leave right now. And he was pissed that I didn't take the medication. Wow. And I was, and I remember walking out of his office and crying for basically being kicked out of the office. And I called my husband, who was back in San Francisco, and I was like, this is so crazy that, like, doctors don't actually care about what I'm doing every single day in my life. And it just was so clear to me. And, you know, in his response, he's the son of a doctor, and he said, well, doctors actually medicate people when they're sick. And I'm like, no. Like, it should be about what we're putting into our body and what we're putting on our skin and what we're putting in our hair. And, like, that stuff really makes a big difference. And so he is like, get back on the plane and come back to San Francisco and we'll talk about it. And I had taken 2 years off from AOL at that point. And so I was thinking about this for about a year and then finally went to Whole Foods on California and Franklin and became really good buddies with the guy stocking the shelf because I had nothing else to do. I was grocery shopping and I was really enjoying it. And so the guy at Whole Foods said to me, I went in and said, okay, I've been slicing up fruit and putting it in water because I hate the taste of water. What can I drink that I can just buy off the shelf? And he pointed to this product, Vitamin Water. And I said, let's look at the label together. And so we did that. And then he's like, gosh, I've gained like 10 pounds since I've been working at Whole Foods and drinking Vitamin Water. And I'm like, I know. It's like everybody's like thinking that these products are better for you because vitamin and diet and all these words. And we're all like living in this like, you know, cycle of just being told like what's healthy and what isn't healthy. And so I came home and I looked at my husband and I said, okay, I got it now. I'm going to start a beverage company and it's going to have fruit and water. And he looked at me and he was like, that's a really bad idea. That's like, that is such a bad idea. You have no idea what you're doing. You have
how many
like,
times did people say that to you, both of you? How many times did people look at you when you came up with your ideas and were like, that's a terrible idea?
And they still tell me that.
Yeah. So at that point, he looked at me and I think was really, really concerned. And I thought there was no better time to actually tell him that I was pregnant with our fourth child. So, it's true. And so then he looked at me and actually he walked out of the room and I wasn't sure if he was coming back. So true story.
That's
and so then he came back. And he's like, so, like, are you okay? I mean, seriously, are you, like, is there, you've not been working for 2 years now.
That's
you used
awesome.
To be on the cycle of working. And so so he, at that point, he had left Netscape, and he had actually done a startup that didn't go so great. And so he was like, can I, like, come with you when we're, like, going to the plant? And he was really worried. I mean, he looked in our bank account and saw that I'd written a check for $50,000 to pay for, like, bottles and caps. And he was like, I know, like, this, you know, you might be kind of, like, off your rocker, and I really want to come along. And then, you know, he tells the story better than me, but, you know, we were at this bottling plant, our first bottling plant, and we were playing around in the kitchen a bit, and then we went to Chicago, and he saw the bottles rolling off the line, and he's like, I get it now. Like, you haven't worked in a physical goods company, and now you can, like, touch the physical good, and it's, like, so awesome. And I'm like, no, that's not it at all. Like, if we could actually get people to drink water or drink a product like Hint versus like drinking soda or these vitamin waters out here, then we could actually change health in the world. Mm-hmm. And it just seems so clear to me that like I got it. And when I said it to him, he is just like, wow, like you are talking about something so much bigger that no one is talking about it. And I am worried about the money coming out of our personal bank accounts, but can we actually do this together? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, it's my idea. And I, you know, you can go off and do what you want. And so, we, we came back to San Francisco and had, and actually the day that I was having a planned C-section at CPMC, we delivered the cases. He wasn't on the payroll yet. We delivered the cases to Whole Foods, and then they sold through 10 cases and in 24 hours after I delivered the baby. And so we get out of the hospital.
What?
It's crazy. No, it's an insane story. And we get out of the hospital, and the Whole Foods guy had called us in the hospital and said, the product is gone. And I said, who took it? I like still didn't believe that anybody was going to buy it. And he said, seriously, like I've saved shelf space for you guys, 'cause I know you're having a baby, but you got to get back in here like fast. And so I couldn't drive at that point, 'cause I was taking drugs for my planned C-section. So my husband said, I'll do this. I'll take the cases to Whole Foods for you, but like you got to give me a business card. And I'm like, dude, whatever you want, like you can have the business card, whatever. And he was like, what should I be called? And I'm like, I don't know, like you make it up. And he's like, I'm going to be chief operating officer.
That's awesome.
And I was like, awesome. And then, and so he's still chief operating officer.
That's
his
awesome.
Desk's right next to mine.
That's awesome.
And
23
it's
years
like,
later,
yeah. Awesome. Yeah. So
you're listening to a podcast of Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Support our podcast and find out about upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org.
Tristan, what was your kind of med? That's an incredible.
Sorry for the lengthy story, but it was like he fell into it.
Not a lame story.
That's awesome.
That's
if you can work with your partner,
that's awesome.
I love that you had a light bulb moment, though. Like when you looked, you literally had like your fridge opened. You had a light bulb moment looking in your fridge. Tristan, did you have something like that when it came to Walker & Company?
Yeah,
you guys both really did get told no, whether it was by your husband. And I know, you know, investors have certainly looked at products, real things, things you hold very differently than software here in Silicon Valley. That's a scary thing. You have to make something. The arc is a little bit different for money when you have to make a physical product. So what did that look like for you?
Yeah, so I had a light bulb moment. I just didn't realize it until about 15 years later. The running story, I went to boarding school for high school. So I went to school deep in New England, in the mountains, no retailers nearby, right? I also didn't have a father kind of to teach me any of these new rites of passage like shaving, right? So I'll never forget this moment. I was 15 years old. I've told this story a couple times, but, there was, I think, a local CVS nearby. One of my kind of colleagues, Ajnay, was up there. We went to school together. And there's a local CVS nearby in town. And I remember you'd have to wait until, like, the weekend. So you'd get on, like, the shuttle bus to go to the CVS, right?
They just caged you at boarding school.
Yeah, well, among other things. You wait for the shuttle bus. I'm like, all right, I'm going to go to CVS. I have this peach fuzz on my face. I'm like, all right, I'm going to shave today, right? So I go to CVS, and I get this razor. It has, like, 17 blades on it. then I get, like, this can. It's in aluminum, and you have to, like, press something, and this blue thing comes out, right? But I see it on the commercials, and I'm like, I'm going to try this thing. So I take it back to my dorm room. And look, at the time we had, what was it called? Like at 10 o'clock, you had to check into your dorm.
Curfew,
yeah, which is also kind of ridiculous. curfew, and then after curfew, you kind of like take a shower or whatever, and you wake up, whatever. So 10 o'clock is a time when like, you know, I had my robe, and I'll never forget, it's like a Calvin Klein robe. I had my, you know, slippers. And I had
you're
like
painting
that little,
a pretty solid picture.
No, you know, I want you guys to
both
visualize.
Of you did. This is like you can like imagine important. This whole scene.
And then like you had these like, you know, the shower containers that are like kind of aluminum, and you put your like soaps and all this stuff in it. So you go and you take a shower. Usually after 10, no one else is in the bathroom, and like I'm by myself. I'm like, I'm gonna enjoy it today, right? So you take the shower, you come out the shower. I'm like, all right, see. First of all, I'm trying to like get rid of this packaging, and it's like all this crazy plastic. I almost like cut myself. So I get the razor, I sit it down, get the aerosol can, get this blue gel, I put it on my face, then I shave. Right? It took me about 6 minutes. Easy enough. I'm like, I've done it. Didn't have a father to teach me. I did it myself. This was awesome. This was easy. So I go to bed and probably play video games, study, I don't know, something like that. I woke up the following morning and my face was completely broken out. Completely broken out. Like, so much so that I was very embarrassed to actually go to class in the morning, right? And I had no idea why. Just no idea why. I just figured, I guess it was kind of the razor thing. Let me not mess with this anymore. Maybe it gave me an allergy I didn't know about, like that sort of thing. Meanwhile, I think Thanksgiving break, I come home, I speak to my brother. He's like, Tristan, you should not put razors on your face. Write those off. Here's this thing called the depilatory cream. Put this on your face. Now, for folks who may not be familiar with what a depilatory cream is, these are things like Nair, where you put it on your face, you let it sit for 6 to 8 minutes. It stinks. It burns your face. But you don't need a razor. You just go and wipe it off, right? Which, just when you think about it, is kind of nuts, right? Like, what magic and sorcery like would allow that to happen? And what's even crazier is, I should have known this. You read on the back, it's the usage instruction. And it's not even the warnings, it's in the directions. It says, do not use this in back-to-back days, right? It's like, this is absolutely absurd. Anyway, I had been using that for about 15 years, right? And I didn't break out because you just wipe it off. And in the community, it's pretty well known. Like, you use a depilatory cream with a butter knife or, like, a depilatory cream with a plastic edge. Look, people are, like, celebrating back here, right? But, like, you know, you're good. But it does stink up your bathroom, right? It burns your face. It has these hazardous, harsh chemicals that you can't use often, et cetera. So use that, let's just say, another 5-6 years. I get to college, and I have an internship on Wall Street. I'll never forget this moment in my entire life. They take all these interns. I was on the trading floor. So it was on the third floor, I remember, at Lehman Brothers at the time. So you walk through the trading floor, and anyone who's seen it on movies, it's kind of like it, right? You have all these type A personalities that, you know, want to heckle and do that sort of thing. It's the new fresh intern blood. There are about 20 of us who are going on the floor. We get through the door. One gentleman stands up, looks our way. He says, you over there, take that shit off your face. Kid you not, right? Like, he was looking, I had hair on my face, like a little kind of shaggy beard. And he's like, take that shit off your face. And I remember at that time thinking two things. Clearly, like, this guy is a jerk, right? It is what it is. But two, what am I going to do? Right? Like, I can't use the stuff that actually is sold. This depilatory cream damages my face. My mother and my brother are tired of, like, smelling this stuff. Like, they've moved on from it, right? But what am I going to do? And at that point, I was like, man, like, I didn't realize it was a problem, but I knew it was a problem, right? It wasn't an opportunity that I wanted to fix. It was just, I remember feeling demeaned by it. And lacking in confidence by it, right? And all that I wanted to do that summer was succeed, right? And I was potentially already put in a negative situation by someone who was judging me having hair in my face, which really, for all intents and purposes, wasn't going to impact my performance on the job. Now, at the end of the day, I got the full-time offer and came back, and it was what it was. But when I moved out to the Bay Area, I realized a couple things. You know, I had the good fortune to, you know, work at Twitter for some time and then Foursquare for some time. So I got a sense for how the software thing worked. I joined Andreessen Horowitz as an entrepreneur in residence, and I had about 9 months to figure out the company I wanted to start. So I said, you know, I want to do the thing that I'm uniquely positioned to do. I felt some semblance of authenticity, and I'll never forget this moment. So this is the third moment of kind of all the ones that I remembered to really get me to do this. It was January of 2012. And I remember kind of getting this depilatory cream of the brand that we used, putting it on my face, shaving, and my wife saying, Tristan, this needs to stop. And I remember myself saying, like, Tristan, this absolutely needs to stop. Now, while I was at Andreessen Horowitz, you know, I was thinking about all these other ideas. And I mentioned it the last time I was here, banking and trucking and obesity and all this other stuff. But meanwhile, I had the time to, like, call up folks that I knew because I wanted to fix this issue. I'm like, this whole razor bump issue, shaving irritation issue, it's an issue that's been around for 100 years. Why has no one solved it? I had friends at Procter & Gamble and elsewhere. And I just wanted to call them up and just be like, what can I use just as a consumer? It had nothing to do with my wanting to, like, start a new business and this stuff. And I spoke to an old retired consumer packaged goods executive. And he said a couple things that were pretty profound to me. So I said, look, I've had to deal with this issue all my life. What should I use? And he said, Tristan, look at photos of black men 100 years ago. Right? None of them had razor bumps on their faces. And, you know, I thought he was being a bit facetious. And I kid you not, I go to Flickr.com and I enter these generic search terms like black men in the 1920s and Harlem Renaissance and, like, stuff like that. I went through 1,200 photos, 1,200, bit by bit. I had the time, right? I didn't find one photo with the man with any irritation, razor bumps on his face, but more on that in a bit. The second thing that I did, just because I wanted to figure out what to use. You know, I would go to the store, you know, I can't talk about other brands, but it's this luxury shaving brand store that has a retail presence. So I walk in. I walk in and I ask the sales rep, and I still do this to this day, just out of curiosity. I ask the sales rep, I say, look, I've had to deal with this issue my entire life. What would you recommend that I use? Now, this person has every incentive in the world to take me to their $300 multi-blade razors with a nice handle and all that stuff. They've never done that, ever. They've always taken me to off-brand, single-blade, double-edged safety razors, right? That they don't own at all, that they're just third-party systems that are in their thing. So I thought, wow, you guys are the foremost folks in this whole technology, but you're not even recommending the things that you are traditionally known for. You're sending me to these other things. And I felt immediately, I was like, there's an interesting racket going on here. There's an interesting marketing opportunity here. And there's an interesting business opportunity here. And I said, all right, what do I feel uniquely positioned to actually do better than anybody else on the planet, right? Number one, I've had this experience for some 15 years that was very frustrating to me. I know it very intimately, right? Number two, you know, I had a unique view on how to kind of leverage kind of software and technology in ways to get things to people, right? And kind of brand building, that sort of thing. Three, I'm a part of the community that suffers from this problem more than anyone else, right? And four, I have this perspective on the world related to culture, right? And getting the word out about these things that are important to people to actually enhance their confidence. So I said, wow, if this is a problem for this, what are the problems in other categories that are similar to it, right? And you start to think, at least for folks of color, we have shaving irritation, we have hyperpigmentation, vitamin D deficiency, diabetes, like all this other stuff. And who are the folks that are actually providing solutions to every single one of these problems?
Interesting.
I'll wait.
Anybody?
Seriously, right? Like, it's really surreal to think about, especially considering a couple things. Will be the majority of this country in 20, 30 years. You know, a lot of folks, you know, you talk about this idea of no's. The reason we got no's all the time, folks, like, it's too niche. I'm like, well, we're the majority of the world right now. Like, when you think about folks of color, how is this niche? We spend more money on this stuff than everyone else. We're the most culturally influential demographic group on the planet. We're the most early adopting kind of demographic group on the planet. I felt that I was uniquely positioned to be the best person in the world to solve this problem, raise the money to do it, and do it. And fortunately, I was blessed enough to raise money to do it, and here we are. Awesome.
I actually think, well, one thing, does, if you wouldn't mind raising your hands, who might have a question for Tristan and Kara? Couple of folks. Okay, so in a couple of minutes, we're going to have a few folks with microphones come around just to give everybody a chance to ask you guys a question so you don't get mobbed afterwards, because there's always that, like, that rush towards the stage. It's interesting because you guys both are solving problems that you experienced, and I think that that's not always what goes on in Silicon Valley. There's kind of trying to solve somebody else's problem, and it's, to me, it's very interesting that you guys solved a problem that you had. And before we go to questions, I actually wanted to talk about some of the other projects that you guys work on just a little bit, because I think you guys both do that in other areas, not just with your brands. The Kara Network and Code 2040, because those connect to kind of the two of the biggest problems that I think we hear a lot about, you know, women in business and the lack of access to mentorship and the lack of diversity and inclusion in the tech world. And so those are kind of two other examples where you guys have taken your experience and the skills that you have and attacked a problem that you've experienced yourself. So what's some of the advice that you guys give to the people that you work with in those organizations? Kind of having taken this, you guys have both worked at a lot of companies, you've had a lot of people say no to you, a lot of people tell you that your ideas maybe aren't right, even though obviously you both enjoyed a lot of success. What, if there's somebody in this audience, you know, somebody who's about to start to solve a problem, what are you telling them at the Kara Network or at Code 2040?
So I think that the key thing for me is, when I talk to people, especially about raising money, and that can be men as well as women, but I think you want to be raising money from people who you actually feel like they understand what problem you're solving, right? And so I think that that's the, I think it's very, very difficult. Personally, I think it's difficult to go out and run a company or raise money on Me Too products that don't really have a clear definition of what they're trying to solve. So that's one thing. I think as it relates to women in particular, I can't tell you how many times I tell women that if you've been out to lunch or dinner with a potential investor, you know, 5 or 6 times, they kind of just want a lunch date or a dinner date. They really don't want to invest in your company, and they don't know how to tell you no. So I feel like I'm sort of the voice of reason, mm-hmm. saying, like, you know, it doesn't mean like you can't come back to them another time with another idea or whatever, but I hate it when people string people along and just, and, you know, and I see it more and more with, you know, young women. I hate to say it. So especially in Silicon Valley. And I was not surprised about some of the news that came out a few months ago about people in particular, because I heard it, I saw it, and I think that sometimes you need somebody who's been doing this for a while and is able to say, like, you can actually go raise the money if you have a great idea and you work with people that really understand what you're talking about and don't string you along.
On that front, and I'm curious, what do you tell women who have experienced anything like the sexual harassment that's been in the news lately, whether it's in Silicon Valley or the recent news about Harvey Weinstein? What do you tell them? Do you speak out? Do you go to a mentor? Like, what kind of actionable things if somebody's encountering something like that? Because I think we hear that. There's a lot of folks now coming out and saying, this happened to me.
Yeah. I mean, I just did a post on this on LinkedIn, and I felt really strongly about it. I think it's a very difficult situation. I personally think LA is sort of a bizarre, weird place. I don't know if anybody else thinks that, but I think it's a very, so I feel for people in that situation. I don't think it's just, you know, the entertainment industry. I have a few friends who were models who it's the exact same thing in order to get jobs. And, you know, as I said in my post, unfortunately, it doesn't just happen, you know, to women. It happens to men too. I've, you know, encountered men who have been raped in order to, you know, work in different situations in Los Angeles. And it's a disgusting, disturbing, you know, situation that goes on. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, you have to live with yourself, and it takes a lot of courage, and you have to, you know, basically, you know, tell people about it, and you might lose your job. You might lose friends. I just don't understand how an assistant that is, you know, working for Harvey Weinstein, like, allowed this to happen. Was there an HR department anywhere around that somebody felt like they could show up? I think there's a lot of details that still need to be covered. But I think it really goes back to, you know, you've got to tell people about your pain, because otherwise you're going to eat yourself up, and you're going to end up, you know, not being a happy person and not being a person that can, you know, live with yourself, right? If you don't get it out. So, and I think that is not just as it relates to, you know, a job, but, you know, I mean, it happens on college campuses today too, and all too much. And I think you've got to show up, and you've got to speak up, and I'm a huge proponent of that. It's not easy, and I get why people don't do it, but it's still something that you've got to, you know, be able to really live with yourself, and that's the most important thing in order to be happy and heal. Mm-hmm. So,
Tristan, what about you? And then we'll go to a couple live questions before we wrap up.
So there's probably two things I'd say really quickly. You know, we've been blessed and fortunate to raise some $30 million for the company. I would say if we didn't have to, I wouldn't have done it.
I think why? Look,
there's the, you know, to start our company, you need like $2 million to get started, right? That's just like a wash, right? Like, there's nothing else that you can do. That said, the more money you raise from other folks, the more you have to fulfill their expectations relative to your own, right? I love my investors. I think that they're wonderful, right, and fantastic. But, you know, I tell a lot of folks, we want to build something that's still around 100 years from now. But, you know, as you said, you got to match the capital to your own patience and time horizon. And that's not always obvious or easy to do. Mm-hmm. And look, you know, with as many no's as we've gotten, we've been blessed with investors that were willing to do it. And look, we've raised the money that we've raised and had some semblance of success in it. But I think the first thing, or the inertia that folks have, or the stasis that they're in, is like, how am I going to raise money before they even really think about the idea they want to do, right? And sometimes it's like, you don't need to be as ambitious to get started, mm-hmm. and that doesn't necessarily destroy your ambition, right? And look, profitability, cash flow, all that stuff allows you to set your destiny in ways that folks do not understand until they get there, mm-hmm. right? It's hard to articulate, but when the folks are there, the amount of verve and, like, you know, what's the word, like, individuality and kind of confidence that folks have is orders of magnitude different from the folks who do not, right? And that's something that I've observed over time. So the one thing I'd say is, don't raise money if you don't have to, right? And really take that seriously. It's an important thing that really doesn't get talked about as often, especially in Silicon Valley, because it's like the sexy thing to do until they do it. And then they realize that they shouldn't have done it, right? So that's one thing. The second thing, and this is something I've thought about recently, especially in the context of Code 2040, because I get this question a lot. A lot of people ask me about mentors and how to find mentors and all that stuff. And the reply I always give them is, I don't know, because I don't have any, right? Huh. And the reason I say that is, mentorship when I was like 20 years old was a little bit different, because a lot of folks wanted to latch on to kind of the one or two folks that would like give them all the wisdom that they needed to be successful, right? Now, a lot of advice is fairly fleeting. Like, you have, you know, certain advice from one person who knows this thing, mm-hmm. but there are few individuals that can help you with all things. And the reason I kind of bring that up, you know, I'll never forget this. I had one young woman who came, she's part of the Code 2040 network, came to our office in Palo Alto. It's probably the second time that she's spoken to me, just asking me for advice. And, you know, I asked her, and she was asking me about the mentorship, that sort of thing, and even asked me to be one. And I said, look, I love you. I don't think that you need me to be one. Like, I'm happy to answer any question that you might have. But what did you do before you came here? And she's like, you know, I had two or three meetings before I came to meet you. And I was like, what did you talk about? And she's like, you know, starting companies and all this other stuff. And I was like, what advice can I share with you that you haven't already heard today, right? Like, just think about it. Like, a lot of folks will go around and ask kind of these luminaries questions just for the sake of asking those questions and getting answers to further validate what they already believe. And, like, I'm the third person that, like, this person had spoken to asking the same questions.
She was asking you the same questions, she said?
Same questions. And I'm like, how much can you have gotten done in these 3 hours of not speaking to us? And if the last question is, how do I get started? Well, you get started by not asking us the same questions, right? And, like, I think too many folks need too much validation about the things that they want to do before they do it. But the best lesson I learned in all this stuff is, the best ideas usually are the ones that everybody else thinks are bad ones. They just are. And no one's ever going to give you validation for bad ideas. And if they do, it's probably a good idea. And if it's a good idea, there's probably everybody else chasing it. So there's no value to capture from it. It's an irony that folks just really cannot understand. I'm pretty sure Brian Chesky at Airbnb wasn't going around saying, hey, we want strangers to kind of rent other strangers' rooms and everybody thinking it was a great idea. It just wasn't. But think about it. He has a $30 billion company, right? Like, in Facebook, no one was like, yeah, I'm going to put all my information on the internet, right? It's hundreds of billions. We laugh. You know, Mark Zuckerberg's laughing too, to the bank, right? Like, this is real. I mean, it really requires a great amount of courage to be able to not have to take advice. And sometimes you got to believe that, like, you're more right than they.
Well, I actually think that's a perfect time to transition to your audience questions. And so that sounded kind of like a cautionary tale for maybe what not to ask Kristen. If you've ever come to an Inform event before, I'm going to give you your very short cautionary tale about asking questions here. They're short. They don't include personal stories, and they end with question marks, which is a novel concept. So if you have a question, raise your hand, and either Anna or Ella will come to you. So ladies, pick somebody. And we're going to take about two or three questions and then wrap this up so we can grab a drink.
So I once heard a wise man say that He got his signature fade with his bevel blade.
That was a great,
and
great
that was his major key. What are your keys or like advice to managers of teams within your company?
Yeah, major keys. look, you know, the thing that is super interesting is that we're in a unique position because we're still a startup, but we're kind of a grown-up startup where, like, the bureaucracy starts to creep in every now and then and that sort of thing. And, look, I have a few folks on my team here now. you know, I am a manager of chaos and sanity all in the same. And the thing that I've had to learn, and I try and kind of, I don't want to say teach, but actually articulate, I kind of try and lead and kind of educate through my own personal action, right? So where have I failed? Because this is probably where the lesson is, and this is something I've said a lot. Look, it's easy for me to get started. It's easy for me to say, hey, Cassidy, go do this thing, right? It's a grid of dick. Just go do it. Like, get started. Like, I'm always, like, very good at, like, that first step, but then I'm learning how to take 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, right? So I never have the, like, get started issue. It's always the how do I get started as a team and continue it in a way that's really, truly sustainable. But in that lesson, especially kind of with all that kind of chaos, I like to say I just want to affect lives in a way that is just very, very great and very, very immediate. Like, I am impatient when it comes to, like, one's ability to impact one's life positively. That's just something that just, like, motivates and guides me ever since I was, like, a kind of young little kid. So I have this, like, step function kind of, like, leadership about me that I had before, where it's like, all right, what is the most ambitious thing that we can do right now, right? And the thing that I have had to learn is that I've just had to be a little bit more patient, right? And I have this wonderful and fantastic executive coach. He's actually a sports psychologist, which is actually, like, pretty interesting because he likes to think about kind of leadership and management as kind of like an athletic game, right? And he says, how do you improve as an athlete, right? You can't really, you know, if you're Steph Curry, you're not going to kind of step function increase your kind of three-point shot based on where you are. But these gradual improvements start to compound. And the thing that he said that really stuck in my head for a long time and will forever stick in my head, he said, Tristan, all you have to do is improve as a manager like 1.2% a week, right? And by the end of the year, you're 2 times better than you were the previous year, right? Now think about that. Like 10 years of that leadership and the power of compounding is fairly significant. And it's not my job to be the best CEO now, but it's my job to aspire to be, right? And the only way I can do that is to actually do it gradually. And this is why it's so important for kind of the managers that I have on my team and the folks that I have such a joy to work with, is not everybody's step function. Some people are gradual. Some people are step function, right? But the easiest way to manage everybody is to do it gradually and let that compound over time. And if everybody's doing that, not only do you have the benefit of everybody's compounding, but the synergy of that over a long period of time, now you have a great business.
We're gonna take 2 more questions, and then I get to ask the last one from both of you.
All right, so we have a question over here.
Hi, it's a question for Cara, if I may. A little bit of feedback, actually, really, from what you said about deciding to leave Trump. I'm British, so Trump is a really interesting thing for us to observe from afar. Last week, our Prime Minister spent most of the week trying to convince people that she didn't want a cabinet of yes men, people that agreed with her on everything and was happy that not everybody agreed with her. I really respect you choosing to step down from that group on this point of principle, but do you have any insight into who replaced you and whether Trump is going to get the challenge from the entrepreneurial community that he needs, not just support?
So no one replaced me. So I'm not replaceable. No.
Own it.
Yeah. So nobody did replace me, but I think it was interesting because again, it was a 2-year commitment that was started, with Obama. And when I received, the call to come and join, I got to Washington and I sort of said to a few other people in the group who had been there, who had been there for a year prior to me, and they were just adding on to it. I said, so what if Hillary doesn't win? And they were like, what? Like, of course she's going to win. And I was like, I was just wondering, I just wanted to know, like, are we gone? Are we, you know, what's going to happen? And, so Trump wins, and then they asked everybody to stay on. And I think everybody was surprised that, you know, they're all Democrats and we're all asked to stay on. So, full disclosure, I grew up in Arizona and I worked for John McCain. And John tells this story that when I came to work for John, I said, he said, so why do you want to work for me? And I said, well, this is in high school. I said, so my parents are Republicans and I don't know if I'm a Republican or not. So I want to come work for you because I want to figure it out. And he was like, you're hired. And I was like, oh, wow. And so I was the most obnoxious high school intern that could possibly be. But I mean, it's a whole other story. But the most interesting part of working with John McCain was I worked across from this guy, Barry Goldwater. And I learned more from Barry Goldwater about our government than I could ever have imagined. And he was not a guy that was shared my views, but that to me said, that's where I'm going to learn. When I sit across the table from somebody that I'm, you know, polar opposite to in many, many ways, you're going to learn a lot from them about what you believe in. And so while I saw Trump as being not really the same ideals, I thought, I can do this because I've worked with John and I worked with him all through college and et cetera. And so I kept saying that in the back of my mind, but I really started to see when I got there in January that his idea for entrepreneurism was to kill jobs in the U.S. and bring people from overseas back over here, or jobs back over here to the U.S. And that to me was job replacement. That wasn't necessarily entrepreneurism. And the other focus that he made very clear to our team was that the focus was not to focus on the coasts. The focus was to focus on the middle of the country. And so I thought, okay, like I'm fine with that. I can go and help create jobs in the middle of the country. But like I remember pulling into Facebook for a meeting while I was on this conference call with his team telling this, and I thought, so are we all forgetting about Facebook? Like, the coasts have built some pretty amazing thing, and especially in Silicon Valley. And so just one really other quick point on this. So I, you know, when I did, the key thing for me, I remember sitting in the final meeting that we had, and we were talking about, you know, jobs that are going to go away in the U.S. And I remember, I drive over the Golden Gate Bridge every single day, and I remember when the toll booth operators were gone, I was like, I wonder what happened to that guy. Like, he thought he was going to have a toll booth job forever. And I also have a friend working for some of these driverless, you know, car concepts, and I thought, there's a bunch of taxi drivers out there who aren't going to have jobs for very long. So I raised my hand and I said, so I know we're trying to bring jobs over from overseas, but like, what about that toll booth operator on the Golden Gate Bridge? Like, what are those jobs that are going to be going away? And what are we doing for these people who are 60 years old who aren't going to have jobs? Because the technology that we're building is going to put them out of a job. Like, do they get it? Are we doing anything to train those people? And the response back was, we're not worried about those people right now. And I remember just being so, like, that was just so, like, unsettling to me that I thought, like, that's just crazy, and I'm not thinking about it. Or he's not thinking about it properly, and his team wasn't thinking about it properly. And then in the end, I really thought, this is a volunteer position, and I need to put my time and effort into my family and into something that I really care about. And this was just chaos. And I was one of the first to leave. And then other people started to leave afterwards. But I think you just have to figure out again what you believe in. And it just became very clear to me that we were just like not seeing it. And, you know, it just was difficult for me to look at a government that really didn't care about so many people and maybe the people in society that I feel like might not sort of have the idea that, you know, the bad news is coming with these driverless cars and the toll booth operators and, you know, and we're not going to stop that. And so what are those people going to do? I mean, you know, so that was really what sort of caused me to say, like, I'm out. So
I'm actually going to have you guys wrap up with the informed traditional question. I will confess, we made Tristan answer this the last time, and I don't remember exactly what he said. We'll have to do a comparison check afterwards. And I'm going to even look at my timer here, because both of you are very eloquent storytellers. The informed traditional question is, what is your 60-second idea to make the world a better place? I'm literally timing you. I'm going to start with
first.
I mean, it's very simple. Impeachment.
We're a nonpartisan organization, folks, but Tristan doesn't have.
Yeah, I'm partisan.
Kara, that's the shortest answer to a question I've gotten from you all night.
Take it.
I would agree. I mean, it seems so clear to me, and I look at it from the standpoint not just for me, but for the next generation. I think it's a mess, and I think about it every single day, and that's, yeah.
He's got to go.
Well, on that note, what I want to do, so this is a challenge, and I know that one of my board members is going to come up and kind of close this out for us, but I want to take your ideas for change, but also kind of applaud all of the things that Kara and Tristan talked about in terms of how they are making change and how all of you can go out and make the change that you are looking to make in this world.
Thank you.
So with that, one more round of applause. It is a pleasure to have all of you here tonight. It is a pleasure to be in conversation with Tristan and Kara. This was number two for you. We'll get you back. Maybe we heard actually a rumor you're writing a book. True or false?
I'm writing a book.
Okay.
I am.
Call us when it's done. So. We'd love to have you back. So with that, thank you guys for coming. And I would like to have Eva Fry, one of our board members, come up and close this out for
appreciate
us.
It.
Thank you.
I'll take you guys off stage.
That was a tough act to follow. So, hi guys, I'm Eva Fry. I've been on the board for about 3 years now. And I'm just going to tell you a couple of the things that I love about Inforum. They limited me to two because otherwise I could literally talk your ear off. But anyhow, I think the two best parts of Inforum for me are the content that continually surprises me and the community. So I'll start with number one. So I don't know about you guys, but I can't keep my finger on the pulse of everything going on in the world. It's a lot. And in order to stay well informed, I love that I can just show up at any kind of an Inform event. I might not know the speaker. I might not have a deep well of knowledge on the subject matter. But then you have this person on the stage who's a subject, an expert in their field, and they're telling you everything that you need to know. And by the end of the conversation, your mind is blown on a topic that you maybe didn't even know anything about before you came. Oh my God. Was that necessary? Dramatic effect, all right. for instance, you know, I did not know much about... Yeah, it's great. We're testing out the lights, folks. for instance, I didn't know a ton about prison reform, and I came and saw Shaka Senghor talk, and it was amazing. I had no idea who Shaka Senghor was before I came to this Inform event. And there were 1,500 people in the Castro Theater. And he was on stage, and he was talking about how he was in solitary confinement for 7 years. 7 years. and talking about the ins and outs of this and how it is designed to break you. It is not designed to make you better. And hearing about this was just shocking, you know. And somehow he came out and he was okay. And then he became a New York Times bestselling author and made the Oprah Book Club, like, no big deal. And now he teaches MIT Media Lab how to innovate based off of things that he learned when he was in prison, because there's no better motivating factor than life and death. And so learning that story was just, like, amazing. So, you know, that was probably one of the favorite events that I've ever been to at Inforum, and I really didn't know anything about prison reform before, and I had no idea who he was. So anyhow, that's one of my favorite things. And the second thing is the community. You know, like, we just heard Kara and Tristan have this fascinating conversation, and it felt like we were literally in their living room with them, you know, getting the lowdown on these stories. And, like, can you imagine the pressure of what it was like to be on that advisory board and have to make that decision in front of everybody that you have to step down? Like, that's crazy. And we get to go and, like, talk about that now, you know, because that, like, stirs up a bunch of stuff inside of me. I'm sure it stirs a bunch of stuff up inside of you, too. So, anyhow, we've been getting people together afterwards to, you know, discuss, like, what's going on over a glass of wine. And it's been super fun. And, you know, the people around you right now, like, they are super sharp and super passionate about changing the world. And I have had such beautiful, deep conversations with people after these events. So anyhow, we're really excited to have you guys here. We're really excited about our new home, and we hope to see more of you. Right now we get to go have some fun. So there are name tags where a lot of you have them already. So go do the stuff that's out there. Like, write down the things that you're passionate about so you can, like, have really interesting conversations with people who might be solving that thing. So thanks again for coming, and come say hi if I don't know you. And please hang out afterwards tonight, and after all the events, we'll go find, you know, fun places to hang out. We want to get to know more of you. So thanks for coming.
Can I finish up? Are you finishing up?
Folks, please join us out there. We've got more drinks, more bites. Don't need to go anywhere for dinner. We promise we'll give you a little food. And please enjoy the samples from Hint Water and from Walker & Company's new line, Form Beauty. So thank you guys for coming. We'll see you back out there. Thank you.